Welcome back to another edition of The Short Code, a podcast of wit and wisdom from the students at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. I'm Dave Etler. In 1971, a group of doctors and journalists in France got together to create Médecins Sans Frontières. Today, MSF, or Doctors Without Borders, boasts more than 27,000 committed individuals representing dozens of nationalities who provide assistance to people caught in crises around the world. They are doctors, nurses, logistics experts, administrators, epidemiologists, laboratory technicians, mental health professionals, and many others who work in more than 60 countries, helping people whose survival is threatened by violence, neglect, or catastrophe. They also bring attention to neglected crises, challenge inadequacies or abuses of the aid system, and advocate for improved medical treatments and protocols. In this two-part episode of The Short Coat, Dr. John Lawrence, formerly Associate Professor of Surgery at the University of Iowa and now at the University of Vermont, returns to the Carver College of Medicine to discuss his work in Doctors Without Borders.
Well, first of all, it's a great pleasure to be here and to see the interest that exists in this subject. Just as a small bit of background of what do I do currently, I'm a pediatric surgeon, so trained in general surgery and now specializing just in childhood entities specifically. And what I thought I might do to begin with is really to get into, well, how did I get interested in global health? And again, if this gets to be way, you know, too much, this is boring, this is uninteresting. But I guess I would say to maybe give you a little bit of a perspective of how does somebody get from where you are, because it wasn't so many years ago. Well, actually, it's quite a few years ago now that I was in your role. But it's how do you make that transition from being a medical student and getting interested and getting involved and maybe some, you know, potentially experience or impact in that regard. So I could start off by saying that as a college student, I had, up to that point, never traveled outside of the United States. I had never been overseas anywhere to, you know, developed world or developing world. And in my first year of medical school, I had kind of said, you know, that summer after the first year, I'm going to do something different, you know, and I, again, can't speak. I'm guessing some of your first years are in mixed, some second years and maybe on above, but I don't want to, you know, add too much bias into what the first year medical student experience was like, but, you know, for me, it was pretty painful. You know, it just kind of seemed like a never-ending, callus in the gluteal region was developing from sitting for hour after hour. It was very clinically / person-oriented, which is what I thought I wanted to be, you know, doing in medical school. So it was a year where I wouldn't say that I would felt like, my education and what I wanted to be doing long-term were necessarily in harmony. But be that as it may, I decided, you know, after my first year that I wanted to do something overseas. And this was largely before global health was kind of a well-recognized entity or embraced. And so what I was left to do was around this time of the year, and speaking only, you know, English as in with any fluency at that point, and probably that's still true today. Speaking only English, I wrote letters to 20 medical schools overseas that were English language schools. So some in Australia, some in India, some in Pakistan, some in South Africa. And I had kind of seized on the idea that I wanted to study nutrition because I thought nutrition and global health kind of pieced together and would be a good way to kind of get into that particular sphere of medicine. And to some degree, I thought that, you know, as a problem, it was an interesting thing to study and would be maybe something with some basic science background that I would have some capability in. And so I, you know, wrote these letters off. And again, this is, you know, as I'm talking about this, I'm realizing, boy, does this ever sound antiquated? You know, there was no, you know, there's no email and instantaneous either reply or this doesn't exist. It was, you were just dependent on, and, you know, what the postal system might return to you. And I waited and I waited and I waited, and literally it was probably getting into April and I hadn't heard from anybody, and I was starting to think, well, wow, maybe this whole global health idea isn't terribly well founded, and what I really need to do is be thinking about, you know, something more, you know, practical to do. And I, you know, the other options for the summer were, you know, advanced anatomy of the upper extremity or something like that, of which I really wasn't, you know, too enamored with, but it was starting to look better and better. And then I heard from this medical school in South Africa, and it was actually a pediatrician who wrote me back and said, we we'd love to have you come over. We've got a metabolic unit here at the Barry Gwinnett Hospital, which was in a hospital in the Black Township, a Soweto of just outside of Johannesburg, and said, we'd love to have you come and spend your 8 weeks with us. And I thought, gosh, this is great. So kind of packed up, got on the plane, flew out there, and amazingly, as I somewhat later learned, this guy had a reputation in the local medical school being quite a curmudgeon, maybe would be the term that came to mind, but he was not the most user-friendly individual, but for whatever reason had kind of reached out or had responded to my offer. And so I got planted on the medical school campus, so basically living actually in the hospital grounds. And the first couple of days went up to the metabolic unit, the research unit, and it was I'd say maybe not the most stimulating thing that I'd ever seen. And they were doing, measuring calcium excretions in babies with malnutrition and so on and so forth. And I was beginning to wonder, well, how am I going to occupy 8 hours of a day every day doing this? And about that time, the local medical students all ate lunch in the same place, the little residence where I was staying on the hospital grounds. So some of the third year and fourth year medical students, which are their equivalent, they actually go up to the sixth year, but they were kind of the early clinical years in the medical school system there. So they said, who's this person? And, kind of introduced themselves and said, well, gosh, what you ought to do is when you have some spare time is come over with us to the wards. So the next thing I knew, I probably set some record for the least time ever spent studying anything related to nutrition on a project that in theory was going to have 8 weeks devoted to it. But the next thing I knew, I was off following these students around on their ward rotations and, kind of incorporated in their little group and had been given a long white coat. And, they would go around with a group. It was a very traditional British system of teaching where ward rounds out on the big open ward, you'd see, 40 or 50 patients and they'd go by and they'd say to the professor, would say to the third year student, show me how you examine for hepatomegaly or to, how would you, demonstrate that this patient might have pneumonia? What would be the clinical signs? And they quickly learned not to ask very many questions of me because even though it looked like I knew something, the professors quickly discerned that I actually had absolutely no knowledge base whatsoever. And so I was kind of absolved of having to be too much of a participator in that regard. But what I came away with was, there's a tremendous amount to learn in this setting. I really don't know very much of anything. And it's easy to get over here and get exposed to this, but I don't really know that it was the most productive venture, to be honest with you. And so I would use that as maybe a paraphrase or a parable for some of you who are thinking about going overseas and doing things, after your first year, is that your expectation levels, may not or maybe shouldn't be set terribly high as I'm going to be a valued contributor. Am I going to get a lot out of this? Am I going to be integrated into what's going on? The answer may very well be no, no, and no. But saying that, I would also say that it was, one of the more eye-opening experiences for me, and both in terms of a different culture, a different way of practicing medicine, and a different medical style or system, and then going beyond that, the whole exposure to tropical diseases and a patient population really in need, very different than anything I'd seen had come across in the U.S. previous to that. So, I then said to myself, well, what I really want to do is when I've had some clinical experience, go back and do something like this again. And so I sort of structured and I had to bend a few rules to make it happen. But basically as a fourth year student then, I went back to this exact same hospital and spent almost 5 months had a completely different experience. And what do I mean by that? Well, at that point I had a fair amount. And again, it's all relative. And as you look back on it, you say, really? I thought I had experience at that point, but the upshot is that I had some clinical intuition and exposure at that point. So I then went back and did a whole variety of month of medicine and a couple months of surgery and a month of pediatrics. And again, I think that as I look back on that, that was probably the best single educational experience for me, meaning that I learned a tremendous amount from it. And Conversely, still came away with this feeling, though, like, well, gosh, I've been a little bit of a, for lack of a better term, global health thief, meaning I've stolen all the information, resources, you know, practiced some procedures and done some things that, you know, I might not otherwise have had the chance to do, but I really didn't get didn't make any meaningful contribution in an awful lot of regards. And I could, you know, make, you know, one small digression here. Truly, it was also you know, kind of kindled my interest in surgery. One of the things that I learned about or was kind of involved in was that I was living on the hospital grounds and it was kind of quiet in the evenings. And so I'd learned from some of the other students that at night, that if you wanted to go to the obstetrical ward, you could go and assist on cesarean deliveries. And for those of you who were at the noontime talk, you know, the way the system worked was it would be a third or a fourth year resident in obstetrics doing C-sections during the night, and they would have a nurse to assist them, kind of like the slides I showed, but basically it was just those two people. So I, as a, you know, eager medical student with a pair of functional hands, was an invaluable asset to the residents that were on in the evenings. And so I started going down there to the point where I then became, gosh, I don't know why I'm even doing anything during the day, and sort of stopped going to the ward rounds and started just every evening going and assisting in surgery. And in the course of about 8 weeks, I went from here's how we do a cesarean section to basically pretty much learning how to do an entire one and having actually done some, short of actually delivering the baby, but the opening and closing. And it was that jump, that transition, that again, many of you wonder, well, how do you get interested in whatever career you're going to do and how do you get to that point? Well, it's pretty hard when you're standing around and watching. And I think I would say, as a surgical instructor, you know, still to this point in time, I realize that, you know, that as a spectator sport, there's a reason that surgery has not been in the Olympics as a most popular event, because if you're standing and watching, it's really not very interesting. But once you get your hands in, it's a little bit, can be kind of like a, you know, a disease in itself, and that it really sparked my interest in that. So at any rate, you know, I kind of came away with, gosh, I've really gotten this good skill set and, you know, have been exposed a lot. And as I say, for my own education, it was just invaluable. So that then left me with, well, how can I possibly, you know, in some way pay that back or replicate that maybe on the other side of things? And if you said, you know, where does one's long-term interest in global health develop or come from? For me, that very much solidified, this is something I need to find a way to get back into my career at some point and, you know, be in a role where I actually am a contributor rather than just sort of a siphon of experience and knowledge. So then, you know, where do we go from there? Well, so the next kind of step or kind of incorporated in all of this was I had been an Indian Health Service scholarship recipient through medical school. So I had been interested in family practice when I started medical school, and they were, you know, and I guess the scholarships, have they pretty much dried up? Or are they still out there? Or the Indian Health Service, National Health Service Corps? I don't. Minimal, yeah, but they were quite freely offered. And I mean, basically all you had to do was say, do you want to do this? And they would give one to you. And so, you know, I took, you know, one of those that literally signed up the first week of medical school, and I'd had an interest in Native American health going back to, it was one of the reasons I wanted to go into medical school to begin with, was a experience working in a Native American Job Corps center while I was in college. And so, I, you know, after the medical school, then had this commitment of having to do a four-year payback. And so that then sort of steered into something that I guess I would say maybe is still germane or pertinent to the whole global health discussion, but slightly different in its national base versus international based. But anyway, the situation for me was that I then had to figure out what I wanted to do specialty-wise, and I'd really gotten the bug for surgery with this experience I'd already told you about. At the time, the Indian Health Service wasn't allowing their recipients to go into surgical specialties. So it was primary care of either family practice, internal medicine, or pediatrics were what they were allowing you to do residencies in. And I'd been interested in family practice originally when I started medical school, and I thought, you know, I'm going to just start with this, and maybe it's going to work out great, and maybe it won't. And I did a year of a family practice residency and kind of had this feeling like, you know, I'm still not sure this is what I want to do. And decided instead to do the payback period. So then went out to Tuba City, Arizona, which some of you may have heard of or been familiar with the association that exists here still with the medical school, and worked out there as what's called a general medical officer for the next 4 years. And You know, what would I say about that experience? It was, in many ways, very interesting. First of all, the whole cultural side of medicine, of integrating or trying to integrate what I might call Western or traditional norms into a society that back at that time still had a lot of people who were very traditional in their thinking, many non-English speakers, and I guess I would say a view of medicine that very much revolved around, for many of the adults anyway, beliefs, practices that were ingrained from hundreds of years ago. So the traditional medicine man was a very important figure in that particular geographic region at that time. And beliefs of disease, a lot of things were, why did this happen? You had been witched because of some event that you had witnessed. The lightning had struck near a tree near your hogan or residence, and that's why you had come down with some disease. So there was a lot of very interesting cultural aspects to practicing there for sure. And the other thing I guess I would say that it really, taught me, or maybe the one of the most important parts of it was, it is kind of, in many ways I would say maybe it was a little keyhole into the future of medicine, in that, practicing there, we existed under a very strict budget. So the way it worked was the federal government would hand down to the Navajo area, and the Navajo area would then split up by service units a figure for the medical budget for the year. And so it might be, without trying to get into politics, if a Democrat was president, it might be $6 million a year. And if a Republican was president, it might be $3 million a year. Now, I can't say that. So, depending on who it was and their orientation to how much backing they wanted to provide towards health care of this particular population, the budget would wildly fluctuate. But the bottom line was, it was a fixed number, and it wasn't an era where you could, or it wasn't a circumstance where you could say, gosh, the sky's the limit, get any test you want. Every patient that was transferred out of the facility for further care, every lab test that you did, you had to think about, can you justify the monetary expenditure that exists in doing that? And again, I don't want to say that's what healthcare in the future is going to be like, but the whole idea of, if I can use the term, rationing care is something that existed in that system. This is now 30 years ago, literally. And is it a good environment to practice it in? Is it perfect? And what I would say is, maybe not necessarily, but it was probably a realistic way of utilizing resources kind of teaching restraint. And I guess I could add or throw into that, without trying to bring too many controversies in health all into one session, but there was also, it was a climate that was completely free of malpractice. So there's, anytime you're in a federal hospital institution, you basically absolve more or less your ability to then sue. And so, we didn't have to be doing anything, because what might happen if this comes back into court, so on and so forth. We did things because they seemed to be medically necessary, or it was prudent, or it made clinical sense. And so, again, an interesting environment to be in. We'll fast forward here then some more, because as I quickly realize, I am getting into the droning phase, and then we're going to have to stop and get into something more of a discussion. But where from there? Then it was on back into surgical training, and might this be a parallel or career parallel that other people had experienced? Very possibly. But then getting into, you're a resident, and then you're still a resident, and then you're a resident some more, and then you're, and so for me it was the 5 years of general surgery with a year of research thrown into that. Then is the pediatric surgery training, which was another 2 years. So there was kind of an 8-year gap. And if you said, gosh, was it possible or would have been possible to do something in global health then? And I would say at that point it didn't really exist. But what I would say is that, nowadays there are a lot of residencies who are, I would say catering to advertising or with a very strong interest in global health. And, as a piece of advice to throw out there to you, this is something that as a group, the more proactive you are of asking, inquiring, and advocating for what are you doing in the way of global health in your residency training, this is important to us. That's what makes program directors and people in my kind of positions or roles respond and say, gosh, we need to do something to make this available for applicants, because this is really a drawing card or an appeal. And, you know, very different, again, when I was going into training. But nowadays, there's a lot of opportunities for doing that. And, and you know, there are programs, again, I know surgery programs better than anything else at this point, but there are a few places in the country that I would say, you know, gosh, if global health is something that you're interested in, you ought to really look at these places specifically, because they very much have established themselves as being very proactive or interested in incorporating that into their training programs. And again, trying to make that a little bit easier, there was a long time that the bodies that certified residencies would say, you know, this isn't something that can count towards credit, so if you want to do that, you're going to have to, you know, spend time outside the system or spend an extra 6 months here in the training program, and that won't be able to be used as credit. And again, a lot of those have now, those kinds of problems have been solved or worked around with the availability of faculty members in a given site. So I would kind of throw that out there. But for me, this was all sort of a period of time where it was, you know, work, train, and a pretty rigorous schedule, and not a whole lot of people that were asking, what is it that you'd like to do at this point? It was more, go into the hospital here, and we'll see you again in 3 years when you come out the other side. It was a little less friendly, gentle period of time. But then finally, it's sort of, all right, the first job, and, you know, how is that all going to play out? And my first job was actually here at the University of Iowa in 1993. And, at that point, I had still this interest in, global health, and I was looking to find a way to bring that to fruition. And, among other things, tying in with the noontime talk, and I don't know that this came out necessarily, but that actually is when I first went to an MSF orientation. And went there and, was, again, very much interested in what they had to say and what it looked like could be exactly what I was alluding to before about feeling like I would be a contributor and able to make some meaningful contribution to the overall health problems that existed in the world, and at least in some tangible manner. And so I went through the orientation, and I probably hadn't been back 2 months from there, and this was without knowing how much history or remote, this is pretty remote history anymore, that people may be aware of, but this was just about the time that the whole secession movement and conflict of sorts that was occurring in Chechnya, which was a southern Russian republic that had some major issues with the main Soviet Union that it was, which was still a unified empire at that point. So conflicts going on, and I actually, the bit of foreign language experience I'd had was in Russian in college. So MSF called as this was all happening and said, are you interested in going? And I said, gosh, this sounds great to me. Let me just check with the people at work and see what they have to say. And so went at that time to my colleagues, who were also my more senior peers. And the response was basically, well, gosh, that's not going to do anything for your career. That's not really meaningful. That's something that you ought to do, later on, but really that doesn't have a whole lot of value, and I won't say the corollary of that is, and while you're gone, I'm going to have to take all the call for the section. That wasn't quite said as overtly, but it was kind of all factored in there, which, kind of leads into the next topic of, well, first of all, are things different here in the year 2011 versus what they were then? And the answer is absolutely. And I think I would say, by what way, and this is where I would sort of say your generation, that always sounds so awful, but sort of implies that I'm out of it as well, which is kind of a painful thing to admit. But be that as it may, your generation has basically, I think I would say maybe taken some heat amongst the old stodgier medical people here who say, gosh, it's all about them. They're putting their priorities first. They're, not willing to sacrifice the way we were. And, is there truth in that? Well, I think everybody kind of, through the retrospectoscope thinks that they worked twice as hard and was twice as bright as anybody today. But the reality is, I think the great thing about that is that the individual needs, desires that are maybe sort of in the non-traditional focus of what we view as a career-oriented or career-beneficial have very much come to the precedence. And so, you know, nowadays for people to say, gosh, I want a job share, or I want a 0.6 position, or I want to do whatever it may be, have it incorporated into my practice, is a very kind of, I would say, norm or non-concerning request to make. And but, you know, again, when I was, you know, coming out, very different time, it was kind of you plugged into track A or track B. Either you worked full-time or you were kind of an outcast, weirdo, what do you mean you want to, you know, work overseas or do something that's not, you know, clinical care, you know, research, or, you know, in the educational realm still had some value. But even back then, education was kind of this, really, you want to devote time or energy to medical student education? That doesn't that doesn't seem like much of an area to be pursuing. Anyway, the upshot is that I was thwarted at that point. But you know, what I would say is that, kind of looking on down the line, you know, one of the ways that I, you know, how do you, or how is one able to incorporate global health into a career? And I think I would say, you know, a big part of it is you've got to make that a priority up front. And so if you are looking at a job and you say, you know, I want to be a pediatrician working in, you know, in a given area, and if you say, gosh, that given area is, East Lone Tree, and there's only one practice in East Lone Tree, you may find yourself struggling to be able to set your demands or to negotiate exactly what you want to do. But on the other hand, I would say, increasingly, if you're flexible and people are interested in your skill set, you may very well be able to do that and sort of say, you know, I want to be able to spend half of my time, or I want to spend 1 month a year, or I want to do whatever it may be. So I think that you know, it's a very different time in that regard. But I think it's wonderful that, you know, truly for, you know, people in your position to be able to have that latitude. And that, of course, that, you know, goes, as I say, for an awful lot of other requests or things that you may want to incorporate in life. I think that's sort of healthier in an awful lot of regards, rather than everybody following the same course lockstep. So. Moving on here, and I'm going to say maybe another 10 more minutes on the monologue drone, and then we're going to stop and open things back up. So where did I go from there? So then it was, well, this isn't going to work out, but, you know, maybe what I can start to do is some shorter missions or ventures or whatever you want to see. And so that's what I started to explore. And so what would these be? These would be trips that might be 1 to 2 weeks, and, you know, working with a variety of different groups or institutions. You know, the variety of places I went to, Cambodia, to Haiti, to Guatemala, over into Ghana, and a couple of times to Gambia as well, and some other things that were more tied in, or we were trying to tie in at the time, with the College of Medicine. And some of those were great experiences. Some of them were very productive and well worked out, and I felt were meaningful, you know, both for me and for the and people on the recipient ends. And others of them were, you know, I would say almost, you know, a complete bust, where you would spend all your time, you know, and you know, in my eyes, it's rather than operating, you would be, you know, meeting dignitaries or going out to dinners or being introduced to, you know, a whole variety of administrators, and it just didn't fulfill the need of what I was looking for. And some of them also were, you know, gosh, sure, we're happy to accommodate you. Wait, we thought you were going to be paying for the antibiotics that all these patients might need. They're going to have surgery. Or it was, you know, on some experiences I'd had was, well, gosh, we, you know, we've got patients lined up for you to see, and then I get there and it would be a whole bunch of patients with club feet or you know, myelomeningocele, things I had not a clue how to take care of. But because I was billed as a pediatric surgeon and these were pediatric patients with a surgical problem, the expectation was that I would be able to take care of them. And again, it just wasn't, you know, in my skill set. And then sort of spinning off of that also was some places where there'd be procedures I think I'd like to be doing, but not at all sure could be safely accomplished in the institution that I was in. So, you know, I went through, or, you know, worked through a variety of things, and I don't want to make it sound like these were all negative by any stretch, but some of them, you know, just didn't turn out to be quite what I, you know, had wanted to do. And so finally, that then gets into the fast forward for what those of you who are around for the lunchtime conference of working with MSF and what, you know, what is that involved or entailed and how has it been different? And I think I would say it has a number of features that that I've found particularly desirable. And one has been kind of the bigger organization worrying about all the details, so you don't have to worry about travel insurance or, you know, who's going to pick me up at the airport or how am I going to get, you know, back and forth from point A to point Z, where am I going to live, where am I going to eat, so on and so forth. That's all taken care of. Second is kind of the ability to step into programs that have already been existing and just sort of pick up and assume a role that somebody else has already done rather than being somebody that's been sort of invented and brought onto the scene and then the people there locally trying to say, well, gosh, how do we, you know, how's this individual, what's his motivation or goals and how are we going to fit him into our bigger mission or what it is that we're trying to accomplish in a given site. And, you know, equipment and supplies, available, reliable, consistent, you know, sort of a personnel around that are also kind of a very motivated group and sort of a clear understood, a relatively clear and understood goal. And so, you know, for me, these last, what I talked about over the noon hour, these three experiences I've had working with MSF have been very good in terms of being extremely productive and working in a system that, where again, the care seems appropriate for, you know, in large measure, my skill set and what seem to be meaningful goals in the environment. Has it been perfect? And again, as I sort of alluded to some of the flaws, deficiencies, potential problems there that have existed, and I would say no, it hasn't been, you know, absolutely perfect by any means. And there's some parts, you know, whether it's the some of the lack of kind of sustainability of efforts that MSF in particular has that have been a little bit of a disappointment. And there's, you know, other issues that kind of alluded to that come up, the sort of displacement of healthcare personnel to being drawn into NGOs as opposed to staying and working in a ministry of health and what that means for a local setting. So a variety of things I would say that aren't, you know, maybe necessarily perfect, but that have been, that I've have found working better. And I guess I would say the last thing on that, and then I truly will stop here for the time being and take a breath. But the last thing is that as a group, it's MSF is also, it's not some corporate structure that sits in a box in some other country or state that has no input. It's very much a group of individuals who feel like they have ownership in what's being done. So it's not being dictated as to what's going to be happening in any given moment. The direction that they take is, is determined by the individuals that are or have been working with it. And so they have an annual meeting and a board that one is eligible to run for. And, the ability to make input into what's going on definitely exists at a very grassroots level. I think in that regard also, I found very refreshing. It's a flexible and adaptable organization. And so for me, it's kind of an appeal for the future to be able to think, well, gosh, maybe some of the things that I don't think are being done well, I or others can impact on to kind of change or alter and take in a different direction. So that takes us through almost 40 minutes, which is not quite half the time, but probably seems like an hour and 40 minutes for those of you on that side of the room. So I'm going to say, rather than going on anymore, and I've kind of, touched on a whole variety of things, kind of hit or miss, but what I'd like to do is, open things up to questions and comments, which could be, pertinent to personal things pertaining to you as individuals, to bigger general questions, to anything else that may come up.
First of all, you mentioned that you only speak English fluently.
Yes.
What are the teams like that you work with? The other physicians, do they also use English there primarily? And then how do you general population?
Yeah, so a very good question. And the answer is that it's like most of those things that, this is one of the things that as a teacher in the medical school side, I always instruct people to say, so if you're not quite sure how to answer a question that somebody asks you in a medical scenario, just always say, well, it depends. And of course, that's, that then buys you some time. In fact, the truth of the matter is it's right most of the time, you know. It doesn't always work. And, what's the most common cause of glomerulonephritis? And if you say, well, it depends, that may not work. But if somebody says, well, why might this patient be short of breath or, you know, whatever, it kind of gives you a little time to backtrack. So the answer, though, is that the different scenarios, it's had different ramifications in terms of how much of a, you know, if I can use the term handicap or liability, my lack of language skills are. MSF is composed of five different sections, main sections, so it's, hopefully I can remember them, Paris, Amsterdam, Barcelona, Geneva, and one more. Now I sound like, Governor Perry, don't I? But, we're not going to go there here. The Paris Operational Center, as it's known, is what the U.S. MSF feeds into. And so that's where most of the kind of organizational side works out of, or how it's integrated in their bigger administrative structure. And so MSF Paris, as you might imagine, is very heavily oriented to French-speaking individuals. And so if you get assigned through the Paris branch, they have a few spots that they designate as English-speaking missions primarily. But otherwise, the expectation is you'll have some French skill set. So now, how much do you truly need then becomes the next question. And I, didn't get into this in much of it in the previous session, but, about 2 months before I first went to the Congo, I started getting tutored by a woman who was, an hour and a half a week was giving me a French lesson. And why did I do that? Because this was important to me to try to, be able to have a broader availability and a better skill set. And, not to mention, it's just kind of embarrassing to not be able to speak, other languages. Digressing for a second or a moment on this, but almost everybody you meet from Europe speaks, four languages. And, it's just so humiliating that I'm still, they're conjugating English verbs for me, that I, I'm kind of battling with. But, I started these French lessons, and so then, when they called and said, you want to go to this French-speaking mission, well, it was, and I said, gosh, I could, I can say, I'd like a cup of coffee with milk, and I can count to 1 to 10, and, which way is the library, and those kinds of things, but I don't have a whole lot of practical knowledge, and their answer was, we're pretty desperate for anybody who's a surgeon, can you go? And so the answer was, sure. And how did it work? The answer was, I was able to get by, it had its challenges at time. In the operating room, it was difficult, but there was usually somebody around who spoke English well enough, or like in a rounds, going around to see patients on the wards, people that would, be able to speak English and could kind of serve as the intermediary. And there just isn't a lot of direct patient contact, not a lot of one-on-one where you need that. And the truth of the matter is, of course, many of the patients are not going to be speaking French anyway. They're, some of the more educated may, but for many, it'll be some regional, local language that they're speaking, regardless. Looking at that, then on to the next mission, I was working with MSF Brussels, which is, I think, the one that I forgot there of the five. And so they are, their region that they draw from is primarily Northern Europe. So it's all the Scandinavian countries and Germany, Belgium itself, Liechtenstein and Luxembourg, and they kind of have that group. So for them, their common language actually is English rather than French. So they're basically, everybody on the mission spoke English, and again, for some people, their preference was to speak French. But in Haiti, it was fine that I didn't, spoke only English or primarily English, and the French that I spoke occasionally would help with patients. But again, Haiti Creole is actually the language, which is, has a lot of similarities to French, but there's enough differences that a lot of times my efforts to say something would be met with blank expressions on the side of patients. Then kind of going back to this, last trip that I just finished in the Ivory Coast, again, this was back with Paris, so back with a French-speaking group, and they're truly not a lot of people who spoke English very well, to be honest with you, but you can manage. And I think what it comes down to is that the more capabilities you have in that regard, the better. And of course, the more languages that you might speak, the better, because this is the other thing. I mean, for those of you who may speak Spanish in the room, almost everybody that you meet spoke not only French, but they would be French and Spanish, or French and Spanish and English. And it's just sort of the nature of the, I think, life life in Europe, I guess I would say. So it's not a barrier by any means, but within MSF specifically, it limits you a little bit. If you speak not a word of French, they tend to then put you into, you know, it's a much smaller pool of locations that you might get assigned to, that, you know, some spots that they designate, you know, this is an English-speaking mission specifically, but because it's a group of French physicians that started it, as you might imagine, there's a real Francophile bias to what, you know, the number of emphasis that French has and the number of their, the spots that they work that are really more French-based, truly. Yeah. Yes, let's see.
Thanks for listening to The Short Coat. The Short Coat is produced by the Writing and Humanities Program at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine, with support from Medical Student Government. You can visit us online at theshortcoat.com, you can find us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we're known as The Short Coat. We also take comments and story ideas and the occasional rant from you, our listeners, via email at theshortcoats@gmail.com. Or leave us a message at 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. That's also where you can submit a question for our advice segment, The Short Couch. The executive producers are Jason T. Lewis and David T. Etler. Our theme music is by Revolution Void from the album Increase the Dosage. Find them at www.revolutionvoid.com.